you for inviting me back. My name is Rose L. Williams, and I am a mixed media artist based in Vancouver, Canada. I'm originally from Montreal, and my roots are in Trinidad and Tobago. So I'm a little bit of pan global, I feel. Try to, anyways. And, I put a lot of heart and soul into making my art. And it comes from a deep place. I mean, like most artists, I think we're all trying to say something about the world around us, you know? And, my early years were spent learning natural science from my dad, who was an educator. So he was teaching his students at school how to dissect frogs and stuff. So we got to do it all at home.
Well, hey, that's a different kind of homework.
It was fab. I mean, one of my earliest memories is looking at our own drops of blood under the microscope,
mm-hmm.
and him explaining to us the different cellular structure. And I mean, I was really young, maybe 3.
Well, and you think about, like, you can look at yourself as the evidence, maybe, but like the impact that can have on a young mind to be shown something that is that profound at an early age and be shown it by somebody who you trust and who can explain it to you patiently and really allow you to explore it instead of it being like, all right, it's science class time and you're tired from too long of a school day and now you have to dissect this frog because you're being told to.
Right? You know, that's the difference between just an educator and a great educator. And mm-hmm. both of my parents were teachers and they were both great educators. And my dad, I mean, we had weekend trips to the Red Path Museum and McGill University, McDonald College, where we could see like the pregnant cows and stuff, and they had wolves, and I mean, it was all just kind of like fascinating, you mm-hmm. know. There was none of the drudgery of learning involved, and it had a profound influence on my development, my little mind. And to this day, the work that I do as an artist is highly influenced by chemistry and the understanding of the natural world and how systems work together and all of that stuff, because my work is very environmentally based. So those are the roots of it. I mean, I was also a David Suzuki fan from very early on. And my other hero is Jane Goodall, because she's like amazing.
Yeah.
Her work with the chimpanzees and the youth and just disseminating information about how science is related to our lives just really inspires me. So I try very hard to imbue that into my work. And then as a child also, I had asthma. So I was kind of like, in those days especially, it was kind of considered you're being too sensitive kind of thing.
Right.
But I used to wake up at night with dreams that I just felt compelled to have to draw or paint. So in the middle of the night, I'd be like the 7-year-old, kind of like I'd pull my dresser out from the side because I had this impulse to paint upright instead of down flat. I wanted to do something like that. So I wanted to do something vertical. So I would pull the dresser out and paint on that with my little kid watercolors and then push it back against the wall before anybody woke up so no one knew what I was getting up to.
I think there's something very... You've been saying how your work is sort of this confluence of the biological, the sort of fascination with the natural world, and then this dealing with some sort of internal forces, situation, whatever, and putting that into your art. But then there's also this sort of almost ritual element. Like when you think about pulling the dresser back and painting on it and then putting it back and then just doing that repetitiously, do you find now that when you're creating art, is there still that sort of element of the ritual in it for you?
Absolutely. 100%. And very astute of you to see that part of it, Jesse, because for me, that's a big part of the whole kind of internal healing process as well as the creative process. They kind of go hand in hand for me. Because when I was 12 years old, I had this horrible pain. We were camping with my family out in the woods, and my brothers and all his friends were there, and I felt embarrassed to say that I was in pain, but it was excruciating, and it turned out it was from my period, but not normal. I had endometriosis, and quite severe, and it was outside of the normal organs that people think it affects, so for me it was affecting my kidney, and my bladder and a whole bunch of organs and ligaments that you need to like walk and stuff. So it was misdiagnosed for a really long time, like 30 years, basically. But from that age and onwards and through single parenting and trying to survive as an artist and trying to go to school, I had to learn how to deal with it. And one of the ways was not just, like when I say art helped save me, it's not just the art, I make the art, but as you say, it was, it's the ritual associated with it. And the way that I do it, I go, I collect leaves, I collect bark, I collect lichens, so part of going on the walk is part of the ritual, taking the photos while I'm doing it, and then cooking up the dye from those materials, taking the leaves, collecting recycled fabric and bits and pieces of metal that I make the metal salts from, is all kind of ritualistic. And in so doing, you know, like that, that's kind of like expressive arts. Mm-hmm. And I did go on to study at Langara expressive arts therapy in my development. And I was already a single parent, and people would ask me, like, how do you get through all, like, you've had so many surgeries and like waiting so long before you got diagnosed or treated, like, how did you live? And I have to admit, there were times when I didn't want to keep living. And if they'd had made back in the day, I would have taken it. But I had to find a way. They didn't have made. And I did it by making art, and I would lose myself in the creative process. Like, a lot of artists talk about, they didn't even know how much time passed while they were making art, or they weren't hungry, or they didn't hear the phone ring, because you're taken away to a different place in your own mind. So that's kind of like tapping into the beneficial healing properties of the imagination. And because I had figured that out on my own, I went and studied expressive arts therapy so that I could help other people, kind of like, well, how can that help you? If in our imagination we can have perseverating thoughts, or just be re-traumatizing ourselves with memories that were difficult when they happened, but they're memories now, it's our imagination that that power is held in. So equally, we can tap into that same power. And I mean, that's all art therapists or expressive arts therapists are helping people do, is tap into that beneficial quality of your imagination. It's not just make-believe. You can, I mean, anybody who talks about how they changed their lives, even from changing their life from addiction and going through rehab, you have to imagine yourself there.
Right. Positive self-talk or thought or whatever you're doing, you are using your imagination to think of the situation as differently from how it is.
Yeah. I mean, I was lucky and blessed enough to be able to do my practicum at Riverview when it was still open. And then as a practicing expressive arts therapist, I had clients on the Forensic Psychiatric Hospital in Cook William. And I mean, a lot of people think that these are kind of scary places, but I didn't find them scary at all. I found such a blessing and gratitude to be able to be somewhere where that modality was able to help people.
Mm-hmm.
Like, quite powerfully. I would go in to work with one client, and everybody else who was in the room, like in the common room, would gravitate over. I would have to carry other art supplies to make sure they had something to do, because I couldn't just turn them away.
Right.
'Cause they were just so attracted just by the material,
mm-hmm.
just by having art materials there. And I mean, during the pandemic, when everything was so dark for everybody, and for me, my solo international solo show was canceled. My Canada Council grant was pulled. They pulled all the international funding.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't know what I was going to do. No more gallery shows. Everything was closed. I connected with a bunch of other artists. We were all trying to learn how to market ourselves online because we didn't know what to do. But what happened was we connected as friends, even though we lived all around the world. So now, for the last 2 years, I've been doing this project where we start a panel in our own style, and then we mail it to each other, and we do another layer on top. So in the end, there's six layers on one painting. And through doing this, we have really found like that power of creating art together, even though we're not in the same place. So there's that, the ritual and the making of art, and now we're joining forces,
mm-hmm.
and we're having to throw aside our egos, because working on someone else's art or having someone else work on your art is kind of taboo.
Totally. it makes me think of how writing can be very iterative, right? Like you write and you rewrite and you rewrite and you rewrite, and eventually it's in the shape that it needs to be. Whereas often, and I mean, I'm generalizing, of course, but in visual art, you might have a draft and then the sort of final version of it, but often it's just, you're just creating it. You make it, and then it's done. Whereas in this new process you're describing, where you're putting a layer on, sending it to someone else for them to put it on, they're sending it on, it captures a little bit of that sort of like doing and redoing and refining.
Yes.
And editing.
We actually, like, we call it the palimpsest project. Mm. Because palimpsest is like a document that's been rewritten and, you know, added to and changed. Yeah. Over time. It's called the Palimpsest Project Art and Beyond. You can find us on Facebook Live every Thursday at 12:30 p.m. Pacific and 3:30 Eastern. And we just share our process for a half an hour with people. It's called the International Art Alliance. We have a YouTube channel and a website and everything. But it's something that we did for ourselves that now we're sharing with others, because we've tapped into something really quite more powerful than we thought it was going to be. You know, we thought, oh, we'll do this art project. And now we're all kind of finding, like, it's helping us get through stuff, and we're feeling, looking forward to it, because we have somewhere to share this kind of common experience together. Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of, for me, reiterating that the healing in how art can make a connection. It's either when you're connecting, looking at my piece of art, just looking at it, and you feel something, and we have a connection. And this kind of connection collaboratively, and we're actually, when we finally have our show, we're looking for a gallery to mount it, we're going to be asking the viewers to give us titles, because our paintings are collaborative. We have painting A, B, C, D, and F. I mean, even at this point, it's like, we don't want to have a big argument on what the title is, so we're just going to invite people to contribute to what they think the title should be.
Well, and I think that's appropriate, right? And I really like how, once again, with this project, it seems that the process is much more important than the end result, where it's very much about the collaboration and the act of doing. And it's obviously great that some nice art comes out of it, but even if it didn't, there would still be all this value in
the doing.
Not even just value for you now, but in value for the people who are watching your streams. And just to pull the veil back a little bit, we originally met for this interview in October, early November, somewhere in there, and I didn't push the right button on the recorder, and our conversation was erased. Well, never even recorded, not erased. So this too is iterative, this process. But at that point, we talked about this project, the International Artists Alliance, and you had been talking about just the painting, and I don't know if you had started doing the streams at that point, or if you had just started.
No, we've been doing it for a while, but we are absolutely, totally green, scared, little novices. Don't, like, half of us had never been, like, on camera. Yeah. And in front of anybody. And it's just been, like, an amazing journey that we've kind of jumped off a cliff holding hands together. But at the same time, it just ties right into what I'm also doing with my work, because, mm-hmm. I mean, I was saving avocados. My mom saved them for her pits for me for like 3 years. She was like, oh, you like the avocado pits? I eat a lot of them. Save them for me. Had them in a cupboard. Pandemic, they got moved. Like, people were like, what are these? Almost threw them away, whatever. But in the back of my mind, I know they're there, and I want to make a piece of art. And I just pulled a print this week where the dye I made from the avocados was just absolutely what I wanted. It did exactly what I needed it to do. It's chemistry, but the more I do the ritual of the making the dye and playing with the chemistry, the more satisfying the results.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that, you know, obviously the science informs the process, right?
But, very much.
But then I would think that once you do it enough, it gets to a point where it feels less like laboratory science, and again, more just like something that you can do, and you can sort of tweak things, not necessarily based on, like, oh, the science says this, but your experience now tells you.
It's more alchemy now.
Yeah.
And honestly, like if you looked at my shelf, it looks like a crazy mad scientist, like, you know, is doing something there, because I have like lichen in fermentation jars, and I have like bear lichen, and I have bark, and I have all kinds of stuff, like dried goldenrod, bags of, people throw out their eucalyptus out of their floral bouquets. I go along, I see it in the garbage, I grab it. I got stuff, okay? The guy pruned his Japanese maple last year across the way, and then he strewed it across his backyard, and I was just pulling Japanese maple leaves. I have such a big stash of dry Japanese maple that it's like in the way. So yes, I look like a mad scientist, and now it's kind of intuitive. Mm-hmm. And it's the ritual part of making the art, because I do all of that before I get to the painting. And by the time I've done the botanical printing, the painting has kind of coalesced like an improv developing over time.
Mm-hmm.
And then I just sit down and I paint into it. And it's, I don't know, it as a creative process, I personally find it extremely satisfying.
I do also think there's something in the mad scientist, the process of sort of going and collecting ingredients and doing this work on them. And it brings to mind the idea of magic, because you're doing a ritual, you're gathering the ingredients, you're doing the ritual, and it is having a desired effect, right? You are doing this ritual to process something within yourself or to evoke emotions or responses in other people. And just thinking about how in reality and history and in myth there is this idea of magic or being able to change people or change yourself through these rituals, and yet there's also this, that it's a real tangible thing that you can do. That just fascinates me.
And hang on your wall.
Yeah.
When you're finished. And you're right, there is magic involved. For me, it's the magic of nature that I'm trying to translate and share.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, we live in a beautiful, beautiful part of the world. And I get to go on walks in the temperate rainforest and massive cedars and Douglas fir and arbutus and hanging usnea lichen are just abundant. And it's one of the reasons why I make this work is because after a windstorm, there is lichen on the ground that I can sustainably forage.
Yeah.
And people from all over the world try to reprimand me, and I'm like, no, I'm sorry, but this was on the ground. People were walking it into the mud. So it's okay to pick it up off the ground when it's been blown off its substrate.
Mm-hmm.
And this is how you do it sustainably. So I'm not going to make more than I need, which is one of the qualities and ethos of my work. I'm not going to go gather a huge garbage bag full of lichen.
You're not doing industrial dye production, right?
No, this is a practice that reflects the environment that I'm in. So if I move and there's no lichen being blown down from the trees where I move, then I'm not making my dye from that. I'm making it from something else that's abundant in that environment. And that's why my work is environmental art, because it is reflective of the place I'm in, the psychogeography of that place in that region. So when I'm in Trinidad, I get to have access to teak and mahogany and all kinds of exciting things that I don't have here, that I wouldn't dream of importing or exporting, because that's not sustainable, right? So it's just about like what's abundant in my environment and how can I reflect the magic of my encounters with these beautiful, I mean, salmon and bald eagles and, you know, heron and just everything that I encounter on my walks. That's where the magic is, right?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm trying to just convey. And just if I don't express it somehow, my art is going to, like, oh my, it's going to stay bottled up in me and I'm going to, like, talk to people about it.
Heaven forbid, right?
All right. Or God forbid, burst into song. So, you know, when you're blessed to be in an environment that's kind of magical, like, how dare I not share it with other people, right? And then when you talk about magic, there is that concept of the artist as shaman.
Mm-hmm.
And the artist as reflection of society. And maybe because I've gone through so much challenges and I was medically misdiagnosed for over 30 years, my body's not the same. Being able to walk in the woods is a huge privilege for me because sometimes I can't walk at all. And that's part of why I feel joy. And I feel the gratitude and the magic every single time I go for a walk in the forest. Because there are times when I can't do it. There was a time where I had to relearn how to walk physically. So perhaps when you lose something, as a member of society who has, maybe I have a certain perspective that I'm able to just see the magic where it's just normal for everybody else walking past it because they never lost their ability to access it.
Mm-hmm. You take it for granted.
Absolutely. And I don't. So it's not just the making of the art, as you say, it's the whole ritual of translating my experience in nature. And I mean, often that's in the downtown east side here on Alexander Street, but there's a strip there down at the end, a whole bunch of rose bushes. And I'm telling you, they save my life sometimes. And it's just a little strip of rose bushes that a company planted and take care of in the downtown east side. But that's nature. And I can collect a whole bunch of stuff off those rose bushes to use in my work. And then it's like my work looks so abundant and she must live in a garden and I live in the downtown east side. But I see that part of it. And that's, I guess, what I bring to the whole table as an artist, the unique artist's eye, right?
Yeah, I think that's really powerful to be able to see what is overlooked and to see the beauty in the everyday and in the things that are right there underfoot.
I think that's one reason, you know, when you go through the fire, for a lot of people who've been through something major, most people have, that's one of the things you get at the other side. You know, a lot of people who've survived cancer have often said, I wouldn't change it because of who I became after I had that experience, right? So it's like art. It encompasses the poignancy and the pain and the beauty in life at the same time. Mm-hmm. In the same place.
Yeah. On that note, and I'm not asking you to give specific clinical advice in any way, but if someone wanted to make art to work through some trauma or grief or whatever, what would your sort of general advice be on how to start, how to approach it?
Well, obviously, ideally, you'd find an expressive arts therapist who can help you along the way, someone like myself. And there's a trade association you can go to find people who are qualified and certified, like I am. But, you know, if you're just like entry level and you have no resources and you don't know what to do, get an adult coloring book and start there. Start with something that you're intuitively attracted to and just start playing with color. And then by the time you've gotten halfway through that adult coloring book, maybe you've started doodling. Maybe you're going to let yourself write a couple poems after you've been drawing a little bit in your adult coloring book. Sing, pick up your bongo that you had in the corner getting dust for years and years. Listen to a bit more music. Sing along. All of that is expressive arts therapy. Every single aspect of it. Go to a play. Go to a play that moves you. That's a really good thing to do if you can afford it. And if you can't afford it, call up the box office and ask them if they have any of those complimentary tickets. Because sometimes they would love to just get some seats, people in the seats. There are so many things that are therapeutic, that are through the arts, that we don't realize until, I mean, I went to a play when I was like 15 with my dad, and it was by Thompson Highway. It was the Red Sisters, and it was in Quebec at the Centaur Theater. And when people left the play and were in the lobby, everybody was talking to each other like, wow, and this part, and once you did this, total strangers were animated and passionate and exclaiming to one another and sharing with each other because of the impact of the actors and the words and of this drama that had everybody just like sharing, whoa. And in Quebec, most people just are anonymous. We don't even know if we speak English or French because you keep your mouth shut most of the time. And it was a huge learning experience for me at a young age about the power of the arts. I mean, it was so powerful, such a powerful experience. That's expressive arts therapy in action right there.
Right. Yeah, the arts very often get just categorized as sort of like pop culture or culture generally. But I mean, like, well, what is culture, if not art, and talking about things through art or words or whatever.
Right? Yeah. Art is if you're writing or you're taking photos or you're singing or coming up with a ditty of your own. I mean, a lot of people have their own little rhymes. That's all of it is creative. I call it creative activity. Mm-hmm. You don't have to label it as art. It's creative activity. And there is absolutely healing through creative activity. And everyone has access to it. Not relegating it to artists only has been a terrible thing in society. And it used to be, I'm old enough to remember, where everybody had a piano or a guitar, and there was always somebody in a gathering of at least 6 or 7 people who could play it decently enough for us to sing along together.
Yeah.
And that was a time before streaming and a time before the internet and a time before. And now everybody's throwing out their pianos and letting them rot in the alleys. And it's heartbreaking because it was a way of coming together through using the arts where we didn't relegate it to the elite and to the people who were trained to do it.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Yeah, it's interesting. In university, you'd go to a party and somebody would have a guitar and that would happen, right? But I'm a sports fan, and they sing the anthems before the games. And I'm not a big national anthem person. I'm not a very nationalistic person, generally.
Patriotic.
Yeah. And I think there are plenty of reasons not to sing the national anthem. That being said, being in a room full of people, just everyone in the room singing in unison the same song, a song they all know the words and the melody to, is a very profound experience. And I guess, you know, if I went to church, I would probably have that experience more. But, you know, aside from that, I can't really think of very many times in my day-to-day life where, I'm just singing with my friends.
So powerful, though.
Yeah,
when I was in a dark place, I joined the Sing City Rock Choir here in Vancouver, run by Laura Lang, who is a pro. They're having, I think, their, 13th or 15th anniversary coming up, with Joni Taylor singing their feature. But I joined a choir because of my experience and my training and everything, and intuitively I knew, I'm not in a good place. I'm a single mom. I can't let this just go. And I took the time after work at the end of the day to go to an evening choir. And it was so, in that standing, and especially the people who've done it before, so they're decently good at it.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh. And then we were doing it, you know, with the altos and the sopranos and
everybody.
You're singing
different interlocking parts.
And the harmonies. It was so powerful and better than an antidepressant could ever be.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I'm saying. It was so worth it, and I encourage anybody to, you know, if you're feeling in the doldrums a little bit, join a choir. It feels amazing, and then you don't have to worry about the patriotic thing.
Yeah, probably a better option. Cheaper to get into as well. You know, you're not spending $100 on your ticket to get in the door.
I think it's more than 100 now.
Yeah. Well, Rose, this has been a lot of fun. Where can people find out more about you and your work? What's the best way?
I have a Facebook page. It's called Rose L. Williams Arts. You can find me there on Instagram. I have a website, roselwilliamsarts.com. And as I said, if you're interested in expressive arts therapy, reach out. Even if you don't want to work with me, I can maybe help you find somebody. And check us out every Thursday on my Facebook page, live at 12:30, and you're going to hear us talk, the International Art Alliance, just, you know, discuss art talks. And sometimes they come out like art panels, and sometimes we're just joking around, and sometimes we're opening boxes and showing the paintings as they're developing. So you never know.
Cool. Well, this is going to air on Thursday morning, so you can tune in later, head to Rose's Facebook page, and get even more.
I can't thank you enough, Jesse.
Great. Thanks for coming on. It's been great chatting. My conversation with Rose L. Williams. You can find out more about her and the international art project Rose L. Williams Art on Facebook. As we leave, just a very brief glimpse into what Jesse found in the CJSF archives. This is from the Brian Eno and John Cale record, Wrong Way Up. It's
It's called Spinning Away, which we will do for the last 15 seconds until Democracy Now! Is up. See you next week.